Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
It was a bright and stormy night. It never got particularly dark in Midtown Manhattan, except when acts of nature or supervillainy resulted in blackouts. It was at night, Peter Parker thought, as he gazed down at the city from rooftop level, that New York City most clearly displayed the abundance of life and energy that made it the most exciting city in the world, as millions of multicolored lights from windows, signs, streetlights, spotlights, and cars shone out in defiance of the darkness, declaring to the universe that New Yorkers were about their business and wouldn't let anything as mundane as the rotation of the Earth tell them when to sleep. Which was good for Peter Parker, since at the moment he was attired from head to toe in red and blue spandex and free-falling from a 20-odd-story building, about to rely on a thin strand of webbing fired from his wrist to adhere to the next skyscraper and swing him safely forward down 8th Avenue. This was just part of the routine nightly patrol of a friendly neighborhood Spider-Man, and the bright lights were an invaluable aid to him in seeing where he was going, as well as keeping an eye peeled for crimes and crises in the streets below. The stormy part was another matter. Even on a normal day, Spider-Man had to be alert to the vagaries of the high-altitude winds that gusted between the towers, amplified by the wind tunnel effect of Manhattan's canyon-esque streets. A strand of spider web, even the scaled-up synthetic polymer stuff that sprayed from Spidey's web shooters, was a gossamer thing, easily blown off course by a sudden gust. Web-slinging was a thrilling, liberating way to travel, 50 times better than any roller coaster ride, but it would have been a suicidal undertaking if not for Peter's spider sense, the preternaturally heightened awareness of his surroundings that a fateful bite from an irradiated spider had given him years ago. The spider sense tingle in his head alerted him to imminent attack by his many foes, let him dodge bullets before they left the barrel and so on, but it also helped him at more mundane tasks, like sensing that the web strand he was about to fire would be blown off course by a sudden shift in the wind, giving him the chance to adjust his aim to compensate. Whoa. Case in point, an extra strong gust kicked in just after he depressed his palm-mounted trigger and let the web fluid spray out into a long, quick-drying strand aimed at the New Yorker Hotel. The wind yanked it back over his shoulder, and he promptly released the trigger, letting the strand fly free as the pinch valve cut it off. Long experience had taught him not to release one web line until the next had found an anchor, so he allowed himself to continue his upswing as he sighted and fired again. The web line struck the Art Deco Hotel higher on its ziggurat-like upper half than he'd intended, meaning that as he swung forward, his web line would get hung up on the corner of the lowest terrace. He readied himself for it, letting it swing him around sideways to alight on the 8th Avenue face of the building, clinging to the wall with his hands and feet.
Whoa.
And slipping. Normally his digits could adhere to just about any surface, but the wind was accompanied by a steadily worsening rainfall, making the hotel's brown brick surface slippery. It wasn't too bad yet. All it took was a little more pressure to secure himself.
Whew, if this rain keeps getting worse, maybe I'd better take the F train home.
Like the real thing, his synthetic webbing was non-conductive when dry, but could carry a charge when wet. And lightning tended to strike at the tops of buildings, making them less than ideal places to hang around or from in weather like this. Unfortunately, he didn't have a change of clothes handy to let him ride the subway as Peter Parker. He'd gone directly out on patrol from his Soho apartment, but hadn't realized he'd forgotten to check the weather report until he was halfway to Greenwich Village. And he couldn't call Mary Jane to do it for him since, as usual these days, his lovely wife was out rehearsing for her latest off-Broadway play.
Why couldn't spider sense come with a long-range forecast?
Scattered showers this evening with a 30% chance of scorpion. Tomorrow, a hail of 38 caliber bullets is expected. And now, here's Joey with sports.
Okay, so he was talking to himself. It was a habit he indulged in when he got nervous. He talked to himself quite a bit. He tried to pick up the pace toward home, veering east to soar over Madison Square Garden and continue diagonally across the next few blocks toward Broadway, planning to follow it in the Bowery toward home. But halfway between 7th and 8th, he felt a faint, familiar tingle. The rainfall interfered with his arachnid senses as well as his normal ones, but not yet enough to obscure a twinge this strong. He tasted it like a connoisseur, sharp, angry, but removed. an act of human violence a couple of blocks away, not aimed directly at him. Not yet, anyway.
That's back north, toward Herald Square.
From the way the tingle intensified as he swung, he could home in on the incident better than he could from the sounds alone. As he reached Broadway, he spotted his quarry. A gang of thieves was running out of Macy's, heading for a getaway van, while a wobbly security guard tried to get a bead on them with his pistol. The guard's other hand was clutching his upper right arm, its sleeve stained red. A minor injury, little more than a graze if he could still hold his gun. No one had died, yet. But this was a crowded intersection, and the guard's aim was shaky. New York's finest were trained not to fire their weapons in a crowd. But would this rent-a-cop have as much sense? Spidey couldn't risk it. Landing on the green metal awning over the front doors, he raised the hem of his tunic to expose his utility belt and triggered the spider signal. His admittedly pretentious name for what was essentially a cheap belt buckle flashlight with a spider mask transparency over its lens, aiming it at the thieves. But nothing happened.
Ugh, great. The batteries are dead.
He couldn't waste any more time. Leaping to perch above a window in front of the guard, he pressed his two middle fingers down on the web trigger, releasing a thick, gluey stream that clogged the guard's gun barrel.
Don't shoot! Too many people around! Let me handle them!
No way! You're probably with them!
Well, what do you know? Another satisfied subscriber to the Daily Bugle.
The guard was pulling at the web glob on his gun, trying to get it free. Just to keep him from accidentally pulling the trigger and blowing his hand off with a backfire, Spidey shot out a thin strand to snag the gun and yanked it away. Now the bad guy's van was racing out into Broadway traffic, so Spidey set off in pursuit. But now this guy had really opened up. His original webbing formula wouldn't have solidified in heavy rainfall, but he'd long ago licked that problem. He fired a strand of webbing to snag the getaway van, but it was pummeled to the ground by the torrent of rain before it could reach the van.
Okay, looks like I'm on foot.
Fortunately, super strength meant super speed as well. Not in Quicksilver's league, but more than enough to catch up with a van in Manhattan traffic during a downpour. Especially since he could leap from roof to roof across the cars.
Watch it, you freak! Hey! What are you doing, you salt?
Ah, the lullaby of Broadway.
Finally, he landed atop the getaway van as it tore through Koreatown. Pulling open the rear doors, he ducked his head down to see what he was facing. After years of experience, the fact that he was seeing it upside down was no impediment, but the raindrops drenching his mask lenses were another matter. Everything was a marbled blur of movement.
It's the bus! Waste him!
Luckily, there were no raindrops between him and the occupants of the van, so his spider sense was able to warn him to pull his head up in time.
The bug? Hey, where's the respect?
He didn't need spider senses to know what would happen next. He'd seen enough action movies. Bad guys in vehicle plus hero on roof equals perforated roof. But Spidey had already flipped around the rear edge of the van's roof like a gymnast on a bar. With the thieves firing upward, he could come right in through the back doors and take them down with a double kick. Except, that wasn't the way it happened. He'd grown used to relying on the adhesion of his fingertips rather than a good firm grip, and in the heat of the moment he forgot to override that reflex on account of the rain. All his fingers adhered to was a bunch of water molecules. He tumbled hard onto the rain-slicked pavement. Only his heightened reflexes let him roll out of the way of the oncoming traffic.
Brilliant move, web for brains.
He leapt to his feet and over the car roofs in pursuit of the van once more. It was getting harder to see. Not only were his lenses covered in rain, but in these cold, wet conditions, they were starting to fog up on the inside as his breathing grew harder. At an intersection, he landed too far forward on a stopped yellow cab and went sliding on his can over the hood.
Good move, webass!
Yeah, well, use less turtle wax next time. Get out of here, they got guns!
Hey, don't tell me where to drive, you creep! And get off my cab before I start the meter!
Gritting his teeth in frustration, Spidey wiped off his right lens with his glove.
How the heck with it?
He got a good grip on it and tore it clear out of the mask so we could see where he was going. He stuffed it in his utility belt for safekeeping as he set out after the van once again.
Gotta stop him fast before they kill someone. But how?
The rain was pummeling him so hard, his webs were useless, his sticky fingers were useless, his spider sense was useless. And he was getting chilled to the bone. He could do what he usually did when he had to let the bad guys go and fire a spider tracer at the van, but the downpour would interfere with that as surely as with his webs.
I need something big to throw.
He looked down for a manhole cover, but the gun battle had brought traffic to a standstill, and every manhole in range had a car tire planted solidly atop it. The van ahead had slowed to fight its way through traffic, but he could see that it was about to get clear.
Hey, Webface! I got fans to get to! Get out of the freaking way!
Perfect.
The cabbie's reaction when Spidey ripped the hood off his cab was not printable in the Daily Bugle. Neither was the reaction of the thieves in the van when they saw it flying toward them. The hood slammed into them, knocking them against the back of the van and down for the count. The van swerved, its driver startled by the impact from behind, and slammed into the back of a parked car. Spidey ran to confront the driver, ripping off the door. But the driver wasn't going anywhere at the moment. Spider-Man's web shooters were still waterlogged, so he just knocked the guy out.
That should hold till the cops get here, which should be any moment now.
After checking the two thieves in the back, who were definitely banged up, he was relieved to see that both their vitals were strong.
They'll be fine.
He didn't like getting this rough when he could avoid it, not against mere mortals, and was glad he had as potent a non-lethal weapon as his webs to fall back on most of the time. But circumstances had left him no choice but to employ greater force to protect innocent bystanders. Still, he knew the cops wouldn't be inclined to see it that way, so he made his retreat in haste, ducking into the nearest alley. The walls would still be too rain-slick to climb, so he jumped up to the nearest fire escape, a short hop for someone who could clear three stories in a single bound, and clambered to the roof. Leaping from rooftop to rooftop, he made his way clear of the area, knowing that the police would be searching for him, wanting, as always, to bring him in for questioning. Really, he couldn't blame them. All too often, the villains he caught were out on the streets again before long, since they couldn't be convicted without his testimony. But falling into police hands would mean the exposure of his identity. The first time it had happened, years ago, a sympathetic police captain named George Stacy had forbidden the removal of his mask, pending a legal consultation over his civil liberties. Spider-Man had subsequently escaped before the matter could be resolved. But Captain Stacy was long dead, and few in the police today would be as concerned with protecting his identity. And civil liberties weren't exactly fashionable in recent times, especially for the superpowered. Despite the risk of letting the bad guys walk, he just couldn't reveal his identity and operate openly. There were too many people he cared about, people who would no doubt become targets if his enemies knew who he was. It had happened too many times already. As he huddled under a rooftop water tower and waited for the rain to let up, Spider-Man asked himself for the millionth time if he was doing the right thing. He could work for the government, get his loved ones in witness protection. He could try to join the Avengers and work as part of the system. He could sell his web formula to the police, let them use it to catch crooks while he stayed home and focused on his family. But every time Peter's thoughts went in that direction, they came back to the one argument he could never escape. Once he had been willing to leave the fight to someone else. Once, after he'd first gotten his powers and begun using them for profit as a TV showman, he had stood by and let a burglar escape, even though he'd had the opportunity to stop him. And that burglar had gone on to murder Peter's Uncle Ben. And though he often wondered if his methods really were the most responsible way of wielding his powers, every alternative he'd ever tried had been too limiting. There were things he could only do as an independent operator, skirting the letter of the law in the name of a more fundamental justice.
Enough for tonight.
All he wanted now was to get home, to get out of his wet Spidey suit and into a nice hot tub. Hopefully, with the magnificent Mrs. Mary Jane Watson Parker as his companion. She was the one who made it all worthwhile, who kept him strong and hopeful in spite of everything. She was the one person he would give up being Spider-Man for, and yet her support and understanding of his double life were what enabled him to carry on as Spider-Man. Just the thought of it warmed him. It was only 20 or so blocks now.
I'm coming, MJ. Eventually.
Spider-Man headed off towards the sounds of trouble. Graphic Audio presents Marvel Comics Spider-Man Drowned in Thunder by Christopher L. Bennett. Copyright 2013, Marvel. Narrated by Richard Rowan. With performances by Tim Getman, Terrence Aselford, Alyssa Wilmoth, Lily Beacon, David Jordan, Kenyatta Rogers, Reagan Wilson, Stephen Carpenter, Jeff Allen, Kimberly Gilbert, Nora Ashradi, Gabriella Fernandez Coffey, Bradley Smith, Mark Halpern, Joe Brack, Ren Casey, Joel David Santner, Casey Platt, David Harris, Patrick Busink, Thomas Penny, Christopher Sheeran, Scott McCormick, Thomas Keegan, and Tim Pabone. It wasn't until morning that Spider-Man was finally able to make his way back to the building where he resided as Peter Parker. Hoping his waterlogged spider sense had cleared up enough to alert him if anyone was watching, he slipped down to his apartment via the fire escape. Luckily, the only spectator was Parker, the very strange and ugly Rottweiler living in the apartment across the way, whose chief activity seemed to be staring menacingly at Peter's window. Despite the lack of any indications from his spider sense, Peter sometimes suspected Parker of being a closet supervillain. Even if that were true, though, he was too tired to bother with it now, so he just climbed in through his apartment window and pulled off his soggy mask.
Hi, honey. I'm home.
He was hoping for a warm embrace from his gorgeous wife. Mary Jane just stuck her head briefly into the bedroom.
Hey, babe. Rough night?
I've had better. I tried climbing up a water spout, but down came the rain and washed me out. You'll never guess what happened next. Come here, and I'll tell you all about it.
Oh, I can't. I'm running late for rehearsal as it is.
Hey! That's all I get?
Sorry. Can't go to rehearsal smelling like wet superhero. We'll talk tonight, okay, Tiger? Love ya. Bye.
Not what I was hoping for.
MJ may have been his loving helpmate and all, but Peter knew she had her own life to lead. After years as a successful supermodel and struggling actress, she'd found it difficult to get casting directors to take her seriously as more than a pretty face, or make that ravishing face with long, shimmering red hair and legs that went on forever. Aside from a brief soap opera gig a few years back, she'd found it difficult to get cast as anything other than skimpily attired love interests in B-grade action movies. And she was growing keenly aware as she edged closer to 30 that the shelf life of a supermodel come Hollywood starlet was severely limited, and that she would need to branch out eventually for the sake of sheer survival. So she'd recently taken up a theatrical career to improve her chops as an actress and broaden her long-term career options. Combined with the occasional modeling work she still did to pay the bills, it kept her busier than ever. She seemed to be devoting every available minute of her life to the rehearsal process, either with a cast at the theater or at home running over her lines. There were moments, okay, maybe more than moments, when Peter resented the competition for her time. He knew, though, that MJ felt the same way about his web-slinging career. And yet she accepted and supported it in spite of everything. Peter owed her no less. He held up his damp tunic.
Ah, oh, she's right, Petey. Being Spider-Man stinks sometimes. Oh man, I only have an hour to get to class.
If he didn't hustle his honors bio students at Midtown High, his oddly misnamed alma mater over in Queens, would be without a teacher, again. He was already having enough trouble keeping his part-time teaching gig, with his frequent absences and his limited ability to come up with good excuses for them. The only reason Midtown High kept him around was because there was a shortage of decent science teachers in the public school system, at least ones brave enough to take on the rough-edged inner-city students placed in his charge. Years of battling the Green Goblin, Dr. Octopus and Kraven the Hunter had prepared him for the challenge of facing a class of surly, suspicious, possibly armed teenagers. Well, almost. Battling supervillains was actually easier, since he could just hit them when they didn't cooperate. Plus, at least in a fight, he had adrenaline to keep him going. Today, after a sleepless night in the pounding rain and only a quick shower, coffee, breakfast, and more coffee to get him past it, he had to stand in front of a room full of canny, recalcitrant teenagers and convince them he knew what he was talking about, or at least that he was awake. Peter somehow managed to struggle through his lecture on genetically modified organisms and actually engaged his students in a stimulating debate about man's right to tamper with nature.
You're not the first people to raise objections. A lot of stores won't sell foods with GMOs in them, and there are even laws restricting their use. And you're right, Bobby. There are things that can go wrong if we're not careful. But the fact is, we've all been eating genetically altered foods all our lives. That's right. Virtually every food item we eat has been altered from its native form through centuries of domestication and selective breeding. Take bananas. They're handy, convenient, uniform. They have nice protective skins that can easily be peeled off and even come with built-in handles. You think nature made them that way? Wild bananas are small, tough, green, practically inedible things. Bananas as we know them today are the product of centuries of artificial breeding. Heck, they can't even reproduce naturally anymore, since they're seedless. They're all literal clones, in the original sense of a plant grown from a cutting, not the Dolly the sheep sense, that came from a single original plant. In fact, that's a cause for concern, because if a disease comes along that could infect them, it could kill every banana plant in the world because none of them would be genetically different enough to survive. And that could ruin the economies of whole countries. Not to mention breakfasts the world over.
But that's just breeding things naturally, not reaching in with tools and screwing around with their genes.
As usual, Bobby Ribeiro was quick to find a good counterargument. Peter admired the boy's deft, independent thinking, his insistence on asking questions rather than just passively writing down what his teacher said without bothering to consider it as anything more than a rote answer for the next test. But it made him a tough sell, particularly today, when Peter had to struggle to make his own brain work.
Well, reaching in with tools, you say. The thing is, the main tools that are actually used in genetic engineering are viruses. And for them, sticking new sequences into other organisms' genes is natural. Scientists estimate that as much as 8% of the normal human genome already consists of genes that retroviruses have been splicing into it for countless millions of years. You could say that modern genetic techniques are just a way of harnessing that natural process to serve human objectives rather than viral ones.
In the back of his mind, Peter pondered a new question that might be worth exploring if he ever willed his body to science. Did that irradiated spider have a retrovirus in its system? Perhaps it was really the virus rather than the spider that had been altered by the radiation, and it had spread throughout his body as an infection and inserted genes taken from the spider into his own genes. He suddenly realized that he'd let his mind wander, and the class was staring at him expectantly.
For our purposes, the main difference between selective breeding and gene splicing is that gene splicing is much more precise. Instead of slamming two whole genomes together and hoping you get good results with not too many side effects, you can go in and change exactly what you want and leave the rest alone. It's like the difference between microsurgery and a bone saw.
Okay. But with that much control, what if somebody wants to use it to screw around with people's genes on purpose? Say, change their babies to make them white.
Well, that's a good point. That precision makes it a much more powerful technique, and that means it can certainly do a lot more harm in the wrong hands. But it can also do much more good in the right ones. As my Uncle Ben used to say, with great power, there must come great responsibility. Power isn't evil, it's just powerful. Whether it does good or harm depends on how responsibly you use it. Are any of you diabetic?
A couple of hands were raised.
The insulin shots that save your lives every day are the result of genetic engineering. They're made by E. coli bacteria that have been engineered to produce human insulin. Until a couple of decades ago, you would have had to use insulin extracted from the pancreas of a cow, a pig, or a fish. Then you might have suffered a dangerous allergic reaction to it. Genetic therapy could potentially provide cures for cancer, cystic fibrosis, Parkinson's, and other diseases. There's even research into engineering fruits with genes that let them naturally produce oral vaccines, letting people in impoverished countries get vaccinations cheaply and conveniently through the crops they grow themselves, rather than having to rely on a medical infrastructure that they can't afford, if it even exists in their countries.
That was a point that struck home with these kids, most of whose living conditions weren't much better than one would find in a third world country.
But what about mutants, or freaks like the Hulk and Spider-Man? They prove that messing around with genes is dangerous.
Yes, it can be. But a lot of mutants and other genetically altered beings use their powers for good, or at least try to. Genetically modified organisms are as likely to save the world as threaten it. Like I said, It's not the power that makes the difference. It's the responsibility.
Of course, he couldn't exactly let on that he was himself a genetically modified organism, particularly since Spider-Man was widely considered more a menace than a hero, thanks to years of bad press from the Daily Bugle.
Don't forget, field trip to the New York Public Library tomorrow. Make sure your permission slips are in order.
Peter could only hope he'd given them enough information to make wise decisions about the issue. After all, they might grow up to be the ones whose decisions about genetic research could determine whether it was allowed to save lives or suppressed out of fear of the unknown. Even in a world of superhumans and wannabe gods, knowledge was still the greatest power.
Man, I am running on fumes.
Unfortunately, he still had his freshman general science class to teach, and that wasn't until last period, so he couldn't go home just yet. Instead, he headed for the faculty lounge, hoping that it would be quiet enough to let him catch a nap on its dilapidated couch. When he arrived, he found the lounge empty except for Don Lukens, a 40-ish but still pixie-ish English teacher who had an inexplicable knack for keeping her students in line, despite her less than imposing physique. She was a friendly enough colleague, but right now Peter hoped she'd be content to ignore him in favor of the web surfing she was doing on her laptop, courtesy of the Wi-Fi hookup she'd been instrumental in persuading the school board to install at Midtown High.
Hey, Don. Boy, am I wiped.
He was hoping she'd take the hint.
Hey, Pete. Come and look at this. You used to work for this guy, didn't you?
Huh?
He came around to peer over her shoulder and recoiled as an unwelcome face glared back at him from the screen. Haircut like a shaving brush and a mustache that went out of style with Charlie Chaplin.
Oh, yeah. J. Jonah and I go way back.
Peter's relationship with the irascible publisher of New York's Daily Bugle was as long and schizophrenic as his crime-fighting career. From the beginning, for reasons that continued to befuddle Peter, Jameson had latched onto Spider-Man as public enemy numbers 1 through 10 inclusive, and asserted it at every opportunity. His rabble-rousing and the controversy it had manufactured had scuttled Peter's early attempts to turn Spider-Man into a TV sensation, and had subsequently made him the most hated crime fighter in the city. And yet, even as he destroyed one career for Peter, Jameson had provided him with another, since he could always be counted on to pay for photos of Spider-Man to accompany his biased coverage. Peter had been in a unique position to take such pictures, once he'd purchased a miniature camera he could carry on his belt, set on automatic, and web into place to overlook his super battles. Peter hadn't been crazy about helping Jonah assassinate his own character, but it had paid the bills through many lean, difficult years, and at least Jameson always spelled his name correctly. As the saying went, that was the most important thing. Too many people rendered it without the hyphen and the capital M, which in Peter's mind looked like a surname. Hey, honey, look. It's the Spider-Mans from across the street.
You never forget working for that man. Even after years of therapy. What's he gotten into now?
The blogosphere. He's finally given in to the 21st century and started his own daily journal. The Wake-Up Call.
Really? I'm surprised Jonah's willing to have anything to do with something called the web.
I know, right?
Then again, how could he ever pass up a new way to tell people what he thinks?
Drawn to it like a rubbernecker at a freeway pileup, he leaned in. In a screwed-up way, he almost missed Jameson's diatribes. Inevitably, the subject of the column was Spider-Man, specifically his actions in foiling the previous night's robbery at Macy's.
As I've always said, that wall-crawling miscreant doesn't have the sense to come in out of the rain. Fine by me. I'm praying for a terminal case of pneumonia. But that glory hog isn't content to put himself out of our misery. He has to make others suffer along with him. First, he dares to attack a wounded security guard named Eddie Barnes, a brave man struck down in the line of duty, yet driven to push forward in the pursuit of justice even as his very life's blood poured from a near-fatal wound. This is a real hero, ladies and gentlemen, not like those flamboyant freaks who hide themselves behind fright masks and terrorize the good people of New York with their endless self-absorbed brawls. Maybe Spider-Man recognized that and attacked Eddie Barnes out of jealous spite. More likely, though, he was in cahoots with the criminals, acting as their lookout and using his disgusting webs to throw off pursuit. But there's no honor among thieves, so minutes later, the rancid arachnid turned on his own accomplices, no doubt wanting to take all the loot for himself and make it look like he'd captured the criminals. As always, he persists in his attempts to fool the good people of New York into believing he's on the side of law and order. Ha! Lawlessness and chaos is more like it, as Spider-Man's actions on that busy Manhattan street went on to prove. Randomly vandalizing the vehicles of innocent motorists as he went, he got into a running gun battle with his former felonious fellows, putting countless civilian lives in danger. When a brave cabbie, Nicholas Kaproff, dared to speak out in protest, Spider-Man started to tear apart his cab, and might have done the same to Nick himself if New York's finest hadn't arrived on the scene. Thankfully, they scared him off before he could abscond with the loot. But how are honest citizens like Eddie Barnes or Nick Kaproff to seek compensation for the damages inflicted on them? How can they press charges or file suit against a coward who hides behind a stocking mask and always flees the scene of the crime?
It went on in that vein for some time. Peter didn't need to read any more.
Rancid arachnid. Don't think I've ever heard that one before.
Still, through all the bluster, he kinda has a point. Even if Spider-Man wasn't working with the thieves, he did his share of damage. A lot of the stolen goods were trashed in the fight. And what makes superheroes think they have the right to tear up other people's property and use it as weapons whenever they feel like it? It's like they care more about showing off how powerful they are than about stopping crimes. Spider-Man may think he was doing good last night, but his methods leave a lot to be desired.
Peter kept his mouth shut, not trusting himself to think of a reply. He'd been trying to take Jameson's new form with good humor, but the criticisms from a fellow teacher, whom he liked, stuck in his craw. He had done everything he could to keep people safe, and had needed to strike as hard and fast as he did to prevent fatalities from stray bullets. He'd been left with no other choices. Hadn't he? He lay down on the couch for a while, but his eyes stayed wide open. The next day's field trip did much to raise Peter's spirits. The New York Public Library's main building on Fifth Avenue was an inspiring place. Its massive Beaux-Arts facade and interior noble spaces bestowing the place with a sense of grandeur and awe that befitted the purpose and power of a library. Ben and May Parker had brought their nephew Peter here many times in his childhood, and the majesty and beauty of the place had done much to inspire his love of learning. He, Don Lukens, and the other teachers who'd organized this trip hoped that it might do the same for some of their students, which was why they'd made the trip from Forest Hills.
As you know, Queens has its own separate library system, as does Brooklyn, but the New York Public Library is something special. It's one of the leading libraries in the entire country, even the world. Its collection is immense and includes an original Gutenberg Bible. Now, this building isn't really a circulating branch, but holds the humanities and social sciences collections of the research library. The circulating branch is right over there on the opposite corner.
Don pointed to the unassuming storefront-style establishment on the southeast corner of 40th and 5th.
And we'll be dropping by there later today. For now, let's come this way.
The sweeping interior spaces of the building clearly impressed many of the students, and even some of the ones determined to maintain a tough, unaffected facade had impressed looks in their eyes. For his own part, Peter gazed lovingly at the building's elegantly crafted walls, ceilings, and columns, and found himself wanting to sneak in after hours and just crawl all over this lovely architecture.
Parker, you are a very strange person.
Before you come through, we need to check your bags, please.
But before the students had cleared the security sweep, Peter heard a familiar sound.
Uh-oh.
He was also getting a faint twinge from his spider sense. Something several blocks away, not immediately threatening to him, but serious enough to raise his hackles.
Oh, no.
Not only did he have to miss the reading room, but he had to think up an excuse for abandoning his class. Now that he was a teacher rather than a photographer, he could no longer claim to be heading off to cover the story. And the sirens outside scuttled the old standby of, "Wait here, I'm going to call the cops."
What do you think is going on?
I wish I knew.
If it's serious, we may have to cancel. I'd hate that, but I don't want to risk these kids.
In any other city, her concern might be exaggerated, but the super beings who tended to congregate around New York had a way of inflicting serious property damage in their frequent battles. So the citizenry had learned to be ready for the worst.
Tell you what, I'll just pop outside and see if I can find something out. You watch the kids.
Good idea, but be careful.
Once outside, he hurried over to the north side of the entranceway and ducked around it. all the pedestrians' eyes were to the north. So no one saw him as he climbed up the wall and onto the roof of the library. By now, he could hear disturbing sounds from several blocks to the north.
Sounds like my kind of dance, all right.
Superhuman speed and years of practice let him complete the change in under 15 seconds. He retrieved the compact web shooters that hooked to his utility belt, slid them over his wrists like flexible watch bands, then flipped forward the palm electrodes and locked them into place. Then, on with his uniform stockings and gloves, making sure the web nozzles poked through the small slits in the gauntlets. And finally, the mask, a spare since he hadn't gotten around to fixing the lens in the other, whose long neck he tucked into the tunic. He wrapped his street clothes into a tight bundle. The web nozzles in his wrists were complex pieces of microengineering he labored long and hard to perfect. The hemispherical nozzle caps had several tiny holes through which the web fluid sprayed, forcing its long-chain polymers to extrude and air-harden into long, wispy strands. With a quick series of brief, repeated taps on the palm electrodes, Peter produced a loose spray of short fibers that clung together in midair to form a fine, almost fabric-like mesh. By moving the shooters around, he could weave the diaphanous mesh into a variety of shapes, such as the cocoon around his clothes. Since the mesh partly dried in midair and had a low surface area, it didn't stick to them badly, and it would biodegrade in an hour anyway. Of course, whatever the problem was, Spider-Man hoped to be done with it in much less than an hour, since the students were waiting. Taking a running start across the library roof, he leapt skyward and gave his right palm electrode a quick double tap, holding it down on the second. This caused the web fluid to fire in continuous strands, the nozzle cap rotating like a lawn sprinkler from the fluid pressure and twisting the strands into a strong, rope-like bundle. A thicker glob of fluid, discharged at the beginning, provided an effective anchor as the web line connected about halfway up the 505th Avenue building across the street. The elastic webbing contracted as it dried, pulling him up like a bungee cord and giving him added velocity. He let the swinging line carry him forward and upward through the air shaft between skyscrapers, and at the top of his arc, as he fired off another strand, he began to see signs of the crisis over the lower rooftops beyond. A cloud of dust and smoke was rising from 47th Street between 5th and 6th Avenues.
Well, what do you know? The Diamond District. Somebody's going ice fishing.
If you were looking for diamonds, the stretch of 47th, known as Diamond and Jewelry Way, was the ideal place. Nearly 90% of all the diamonds sold in the United States passed through this single block. But of course, security was ferociously tight. A run-of-the-mill jewel thief would be crazy to try to rob any of its shops or exchanges. But from the mess up ahead, it was already clear that whoever Spidey was about to face was no ordinary criminal. As he swung toward the noises, Spider-Man cast an eye north to the roof of the Baxter Building, hoping to glimpse the Fantastic Four racing down from their headquarters to tackle the crisis. That would save him the trouble, and he could get back to his students. But of course, he had no such luck. Even if they weren't off saving some distant planet from being eaten by a mutant space goat or something, the FF tended to concentrate on fate of the world stuff, and left street crime to street-level heroes like him.
Face it, Captain. You're the only ship in the Quadrant again.
He came in for a landing atop a building on the south side of the street and peered down over the edge.
Nuts. Not robots. I hate robots.
But robots they were, over a half dozen of them. They were six-legged and heavily built, about the size of horses, and they were methodically making the rounds of the street from east to west, smashing in the fronts of the diamond exchanges and using elaborate manipulator arms to steal the diamonds and dump them into hoppers in their backs. The police were firing at the armored beasts with no effect. Normally, he'd prefer to swoop in and clobber the bad guys unannounced, taking them off guard. But he wasn't sure these robots had a guard to be taken off of or whatever, and he didn't want to catch any stray bullets. So he swung down to perch atop the subway kiosk alongside the police.
I'd heard those new robot toys were a smash, but this is ridiculous.
Stay out of this, wall crawler.
Hey, wait a minute. We aren't having much luck with these things. I've been around this town a long time, and I've seen Spider-Man tackle worse menaces than this.
We're supposed to protect civilians, not let them fight for us.
Hello, crouching right here. For the record, I prefer the term talented amateur. And also for the record, I'm going in there whether you ask me to or not. I'd just appreciate it if you avoided firing bullets at the area I'm about to be in. Okay?
You got it. Now face front!
Spidey did as the cop advised and saw that one of the robots was trundling his way. He flipped forward, did a mid-air somersault, and shot out a web to snag one of the light fixtures extending from the Jewelry 55 exchange building. up above the sign that boasted world's largest jewelry exchange in big red letters. Luckily, the cops seemed to be holding their fire. He clutched the webline two-handed and swung down to kick the approaching robot in what looked like its forward sensor cluster. But its manipulator arms moved with striking speed, clutching his ankles before they hit. The force of his impact pushed it back a few feet, but its legs moved deftly to keep it in balance. It tossed Spidey back over its body and continued on its way. He caught himself on a lamppost and swung around it to hurtle back at the robot. Landing on its back, he coated its manipulators with a thick layer of webbing, using a firm, continuous pressure on the electrodes to push the nozzle cap forward, allowing the web fluid to gush out around its edges in a thick, gooey stream, its stickiest form.
You shouldn't go out without your mittens. You'll catch your death of cold.
The manipulators strained against their web cocoons without success, so Spidey began clambering over the robot.
There's gotta be a control panel or something.
But then his spider sense twinged, alerting him that the robot had deployed a pretty potent laser and was using it to cut the webs free. He clambered under the robot's body as its arms reached back for him, but found that to be a mistake as its middle pair of legs tried to squash his head between them.
Hey! Not cool!
He pulled back and webbed them together securely, hoping the laser couldn't reach underneath.
Now that I have a moment, let's try the obvious.
Twisting over to get his legs under him against the pavement, Spidey thrust upward and flipped the robot onto its back.
Oh, that was easy.
But the robot's back was rounded enough that it was able to rock itself and regain its footing even with one pair of its legs hobbled. It then continued its course for the 55 Exchange building.
Oh man, these things are tough. At least for once the deadly robots aren't after me personally. They don't attack me unless I attack them. But there's still people inside the exchange, so here I go attacking them again.
He decided to play it smart this time. He leapt back up to one of the light fixtures, hit the robot's rear with another web line, and jumped down, using the fixture's support pole as a pulley to lift the robot into the air.
Hey, look, a piñata!
He kicked it with all his might as it rose past him, hoping to damage something inside it. The force of the kick was sufficient to send it up and over the light fixture, more or less. A collision with a window air conditioner halted its trajectory, and as it fell, it smashed the light fixture itself and a security camera before toppling to the sidewalk. One of its legs snapped off in the process.
Hey, now we're getting somewhere!
But Spider-Man's spirit sank as another robot trundled out of the adjacent smashed-up storefront and used its laser to cut the first robot's middle legs free of Spidey's webbing. The damaged robot clambered up onto its five remaining legs and came forward once more, awkwardly but effectively.
Aw, man! Who built these things?
The damaged robot was still heading for the exchange, with its rescuer close behind. Spider-Man had to delay them long enough for the people to get out. Luckily, the guards inside had seen the robots closing in and were directing the occupants to the exits. Spidey leapt up to perch on the exchange sign and sprayed a wide-angle mesh between the corner of the building and the lamppost out front, and then another between that and the adjacent lamppost, forming a barricade between the robots and the fleeing occupants. If he'd gauged their behavior correctly, reactive rather than anticipative, the robots would try to push through the webbing first, and it took Hulk-level strength to do that. But then they'd no doubt deploy their lasers to cut through it. That was something he'd have to stop. But his web shooter LEDs alerted him that they were running dry. He plugged in new cartridges from his belt as quickly as he could, but one of the robots was already starting to push through the incomplete web. Spidey had no more time to replace all the web cartridges, so he had to settle for just a couple of fresh ones in each shooter. He used the fresh web supply to trap the robot within the barrier and pin it to the ground. It strained with no success, and though its laser began cutting its front clear, Spider-Man doubted that the beam could reach to the back. But its fellows could help it get free, and they were drawing closer. Hoping to hurry the evacuation along, Spidey ducked down into the exchange building.
Hurry, everybody! Get out while you can!
But that was easier said than done. The place had been packed with vendors and buyers before the attack. Since a diamond merchant didn't need more than a small booth to do business from, there was room in the huge exchange for hundreds of them. Many of the dealers were still busy trying to secure or pack up their stocks.
Come on, people! Diamonds are forever, but you aren't! Hurry up!
He hustled people out of the building as fast as he could with help from building security. His spider sense alerted him again, so he rushed back out to see that the robots had nearly cut through his webbing.
Ah, great.
He leapt up to his former perch on the sign, readying himself to launch into a renewed attack. But his hairs suddenly stood on end, as much from a sudden change in the air as from a spider sense, and he reflexively jumped to a nearby flagpole, just as a lightning bolt struck his position, blowing several letters off the sign and shattering a couple of windows directly above it. Pulling himself up on the flagpole, Spidey focused in on the source of the attack. A green and yellow garbed figure who stood atop a red brick building across the way.
Oh no, don't tell me.
That's right, Spider-Man. Electro's back and he's in charge.
And Spider-Man is sick of cheesy villains who introduce themselves in the third person.
Electro was an old school supervillain, one of Spider-Man's earliest foes, though not one of his most active. A former electrical lineman named Max Dillon, he'd gained the power to control and channel electricity in some freak accident, and had used it to turn to larceny. The accident had also apparently crippled his fashion sense. His green and yellow outfit was one of the most garish ones Spider-Man had encountered, with lightning bolt patterns in a sort of weird suspender shape running from waistband to shoulders, and a black cowl with a big yellow lightning starburst sort of thing on the front, its jagged points sticking out stiffly from the sides of his face, with a big one sticking up on top. Spider-Man thought it looked like a cardboard mask from a school play. I'm a happy little starfish, except I'm not so good with scissors. But Dillon was tough and dangerous, so Spidey supposed he could get away with looking like a complete doofus. Spidey shot a web line, but Electro saw it coming and dodged. Spidey hurtled across the street at him, but Electro jumped up to the wall of the taller building next door and began scaling it, clinging to the building electrostatically. Not unlike how Spidey did it, albeit by amplifying his body's charge rather than relying on molecular van der Waals forces. He climbed around to the front of the building. Spidey landed on the wall below.
Come on, Max. You can't beat me at my own game.
Oh, yeah? Remember this move?
Electro extended a hand towards Spider-Man, who suddenly found himself slipping off the wall. Spider-Man fell several stories before he caught himself on a building ledge.
I'd almost forgotten he could do that. I thought he had, too.
Once, when Spidey had been foolish enough to taunt him with some crack about static, Electro had had the idea to draw all the static electricity in the area toward him, canceling out Spider-Man's clinging ability. It was a trick that Electro had rarely tried again. He wasn't the brightest bulb on the marquee, and in the heat of battle, he generally didn't bother to reason it out. But he seemed to be in top form today.
Neat trick, Sparky! Now let me remind you of some of mine!
Spider-Man leapt up after Electro. Grabbing windowsills to pull himself up, but Electro let himself slide down the side of the building, firing off a lightning bolt at Spidey as he slid past. Spider-Man jumped clear and fired a web across the street, swinging down to the sidewalk to meet Electro at ground level. Spidey considered some crack about electricity and ground level, but skipped it. He was in the mood to talk with his fists for a while, but there was a crackle in the air, and a robot trundled forward to stand between Spider-Man and his prey.
I got a few new tricks this time, wall crawler.
Spider-Man looked around to see several other robots closing in on him.
Computer commands, mechanical movements, it's all done with electric signals. I could fry you myself, but I think I'd rather let my friends do it while I sit back and enjoy the show.
Spidey was glad his mask hid the expression of dismay on his face. If Electro had figured out how to manipulate electronic devices, he could be virtually unstoppable. He could rip off ATMs, bring traffic to a standstill, crash planes, and worse. Spider-Man could only hope that Dillon's limited imagination hadn't reached that realization yet.
Great, so you turned yourself into Remote Control Man.
Spider-Man leapt up to perch on another wall.
Why don't you find a sofa and channel surf with a beer and bag of chips?
Nah, I like this show.
Electro gestured, and a robot took aim at Spider-Man with a laser beam.
Time to go.
Luckily, the robots were slow moving, and Spidey had no trouble leaping clear. But the equation had changed now. Before, their target had been the diamonds, and he had been simply a distraction. Now these titanium tinker toys were targeting him. And any laser that could cut through his webbing could easily cut through flesh and bone.
I got speed on my side, though, so let's make the most of it.
Instead of waiting for the robots to strike, Spider-Man took the fight to them, diving into the fray and relying on his speed, agility, and spider sense to stay one hop ahead of the lasers. While the robots were still trying to get a bead on him, he was able to grab or web their laser arms and rip them free, ducking or leaping clear of their manipulator arms before they could catch him. He smashed at robot joints with hands and feet, looking for weak spots. He was able to cripple a few limbs, but not enough on any one robot to put it permanently out of action. Then, one of them got in a lucky blow. His danger sense warned him, but he was hemmed in and couldn't fully twist away before a cutter arm slashed across the back of his neck.
Yikes! An inch closer and I'd have been the amazing quadriplegic man. Or worse.
As it was just a bad pain in the neck and some blood trickling down his back. Before it could get any worse, he reached back, grabbed the cutter arm, and ripped it free. He used it as a club to smash some robot limbs aside, sustaining another slash across the thigh before he could jump clear to regroup. Landing on the side of a building, he took a second to check his wounds, confirming that they were nothing more than moderate cuts. He sprayed a bit of webbing on the wounds to staunch the bleeding.
First blood's mine! Keep at him, boys! You're wearing him down!
Hey, wait a minute. Electro could be pocketing a fortune in diamonds while his pets take care of me. So why is he standing there playing armchair quarterback? He's not the type whose sole purpose is revenge against little old me. He had no way of knowing I'd even show up for this.
So why was Electro focusing on this battle instead of the diamond heist? Maybe because he had to. He had to be consciously directing the robots. That was a relief, actually. If he was just puppeteering their bodies, controlling the electrical impulses in their servos rather than actually affecting their programming, that meant this new ability was not as dangerous as it could have been.
Shut him down, and I bet the robot shut down too.
Maybe the police were thinking the same thing.
Electro! Stand down or we open fire!
Oh yeah?
Electro turned his gaze on the fancy diamond-themed streetlights flanking the cops. Both fixtures exploded with sparks. And blue-white electric arcs began leaping between them and licking out at all surrounding metal, including the police cars and guns. The cops scattered. A police car erupted into flames. Luckily, a fire truck was already on the scene. But Spider-Man was already taking advantage of Electro's distraction. Spider-Man had leapt across the street and ricocheted off a building to come at Electro from an unexpected direction, firing a glob of webbing to cover the villain's mask and blind him. Electro reflexively grabbed at the obstruction, getting his hand caught in the still-drying web. But a second later, he began burning the web away with an electric discharge from his fingers, using the other hand to fire a lightning bolt. Spidey dodged it, landing in a crouch, and sweeping a leg around to take his enemy's feet out from under him. But just that brief contact was like kicking a live cable. The current running through his muscles forced them to contract, canceling much of the force of the kick. Electro only staggered and regained his balance, while Spidey rolled away to gain some distance.
Too bad you left your rubber costume at home, hero. You can't touch this.
I never liked that song.
The street around Spider-Man was strewn with pieces torn off the robots, including a heavy leg not far from him. He snagged the leg with a web line and slung it at Electro. Dylan knew better than to try to zap it with lightning. He might heat it up, even partially melt it, but he wouldn't cancel its momentum, so he'd just end up getting hit with molten titanium instead of the solid kind. So he just ducked, covering his head, which gave Spider-Man enough time to spray him with a web mesh to pin him in his crouch. Dylan fired finger bolts to snap the threads and struggled back upright, then fired lightning again as the web spinner came closer. Spidey kept dodging, binding Electro's hands and pinning his feet with webbing. Then he picked up the robot leg again and hefted it as a club.
Luckily, titanium isn't very conductive.
Might want to look behind you, webhead.
Spider-Sense told him that it was no ruse, and he spun around.
Oh, no.
The robots were now stomping along at random, spreading out in all directions, smashing aside cars and knocking over street lamps. A few were already out of the Diamond District and on their way out of his sight, shrugging off police fire.
With Electro distracted by the fight, the robots didn't shut down. They went out of control.
Shut them down, Electro! Now!
He brandished the robot leg menacingly.
I don't think so. Knock me out and they just keep going and going and going. Let me go, and I might just stop them for you.
Stop them now and I'll consider it.
No deal. How do I know you'll keep your end of the bargain?
Hello? Me, champion of justice? You, career scumbag? Which one of us is more trustworthy?
Hey! All I know is what I read in the Bugle. According to Jameson, you're as crooked as I am, so I'd like some insurance.
How about we shake hands?
How about you do what I tell you? Walk away, let me do the same, and I'll stop him. Better decide fast, wall crawler.
He really had no choice.
All right.
Even Spider-Man didn't have the strength to snap his own webbing, but he was able to dig his fingers in between the strands where it met Electro's sleeve and tear one of his hands free.
I'll take it from here, web face.
Spider-Man stood clear while Electro zapped the rest of the webs away.
Now stop the robots!
Why? They make such a great distraction!
Why, you lousy...
Better get moving, hero!
Grinding his teeth beneath his mask, Spider-Man backed away from Electro, heading toward the nearest robot.
What a maroon.
Dylan turned and moseyed away. Hoping to salvage something, Spidey reset his web shooter to activate its spring-loaded launcher, firing a spider tracer at Electro in hopes of tracking him later. But the tiny arachnid-shaped microelectronic tracker shorted out on impact with Dylan's charged body.
Crap!
Unleashing his anger, Spider-Man pounced onto the robot, smashing at its joints and vital spots. It fought back, but he tore off the front half of its remaining arm, then did the same with enough of its legs that once he flipped it on its back, it was unable to regain its footing. But in the time it had taken to do that, the remaining robots had made more headway out into the city in all directions.
Which way? How can I stop them all?
There were so many places within just a few blocks that could be endangered. Rockefeller Center, Saks, St. Patrick's Cathedral, Radio City, Times Square.
The library.
But if he went after his kids, thousands of other people might be endangered. He considered going back and recapturing Electro, finding some way to coerce him into stopping the robots, but he tried that already with no success. Even if he could somehow intimidate Electro into backing down, it would take too long. Spidey shot a web line, and within a minute was on top of the block's tallest building. The robots were spreading out, following the streets. A couple were heading up toward Rock Plaza and St. Pat's, at least one was nearing Broadway, and one was heading in the general direction of Grand Central. But two were on their way down Fifth, already halfway to the library. Spider-Man's duty was to protect the whole city, but Peter Parker had a more specific responsibility.
I gotta look after my kids.
He swung back to the southeast.